Thank you so much for that introduction. And I'm absolutely delighted and so deeply honored to be here today speaking at the University of Geneva. And I would like to thank especially the Vice Rector, Michel Lorez, as well as the Dean, Christine Chapuis, Dean of the Law Faculty. And I think it's wonderful that the Law Faculty is taking a lead on what is absolutely a crucial issue in this day and age, together with the team of Gender Studies Institute at the University of Geneva. Thank you very much for having me here. Now, I will speak for about 45 to 50 minutes on the topic of gender and human rights. Is it a success, a failure, or a new imperialism? On New Year's Eve, 2015, as you all know, hundreds of women were sexually molested during a celebration near Cologne's main cathedral. Headline news splashed around the world suggested that most of the assaults were carried out by Middle Eastern or North African-looking men, making the attacks a turning point in Europe's refugee debate. It quite specifically led to a very serious challenge of the rationality and even the saneness of Chancellor Merkel's open-door policy. In allowing over 1 million refugees fleeing from conflict zones, mainly Syria and Iraq, to enter into the country. These are images that we have seen on our television screens, in the print media, and on social network over the course of the past year. While only 3 of the 58 men were ultimately charged as suspects were refugees, the racial origins of the perpetrators, who were mostly non-white, non-German citizens, was immediately collapsed with Islam, raising alarming charges such as the Islamic rape of Europe in this popular Polish magazine. And here you see brown hands mauling a white female body wrapped in the European flag. Or images, as you know, of Alan Kurdi, the little 3-year-old Syrian boy who died crossing the Mediterranean with his family in September 2015. Here depicted by Charlie Hebdo as a sexual abuser in adulthood had he survived. Charlie Hebdo is the French satirical magazine that has become the beacon of free expression globally since the January 2015 attacks in Paris. And as you can see, the caption reads, "What would Ayan Kurdi have grown up to be? Ass groper in Germany." Given the sexual violence against women, as we all know, rarely triggers this level of alarm or even interest, even in Germany, we have to question whether it was the nationality and religion of the attackers rather than the horrid treatment of the women that was more at stake. The slogan, "Rape Refugee," brandished by Pegida, the extreme right-wing German party, at its rally after the assaults, suggests that the victims have merely become part of the background of the discussions and debates. The dominant narrative, partly supported by the media, is that sexual violence is a crime committed by others, non-white, non-European, Muslim men, who come from elsewhere. This familiar Orientalist discourse from the past is coupled in the contemporary period with an Islamophobia that's rife in Europe and has flourished since 9/11, and strengthened, of course, by the subsequent attacks in Western European cities. Now, let me contrast this narrative with another. Thousands of young women and men throughout India marched in protest against a brutal, vicious gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old young woman, Jyoti Singh Pandey, and it was also an assault on her male companion, in a moving bus on the Delhi streets on the night of December 16, 2012. The protesters demanded an end to the culture of pervasive sexism and rape. The government responded by focusing almost exclusively on the reform of the criminal law, including incorporating the death penalty for rape leading to death or maiming of the victim, as well as the strengthening of law enforcement machinery, and installing CCTV cameras on public transport. It refused recommendations to remove the exemption of marital rape, as well as colonial and Victorian provisions in the law dealing with the outraging of a woman's modesty and chastity, reflecting a dominant nationalist view that equates Indian women's virtue and chastity with notions of honor. And once again, you see the flag is used to equate the honor and integrity of women with a nation's honor. The new legal edifice was focused primarily on security, and it left intact what I describe as gender dualism, that is, men and women as distinct, fixed, separate categories, where, as well as gender stereotypes, where women are victims, passive, vulnerable, and repositories of Indian culture, and men are perpetrators or protectors. The gruesome attacks in Delhi became a subject matter of a documentary entitled India's Daughters, produced by a little-known UK-based filmmaker, Leslie Edwin. In the documentary, Edwin includes lengthy interviews of one of the convicted rapists and killers, who justifies the rape on the grounds of the woman's dress, as well as her behavior of being out so late at night, as well as the defense lawyers who offered similarly sexist remarks comparing a woman to a flower in need of protection. If she falls into the gutter, she's spoiled. If she's put into a temple, she's worshipped. The film, however, ignited a furious controversy that spiraled into being about the denigrating representations of Indian men by a white Western filmmaker who had hurt the sentiments of the Indian nation. In response, Edwin appealed to no one less than Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is a member of the extreme Hindu right nationalist party, controversially praising his stand on women's rights, as well as India's civilized democracy, to screen the film. The film was, of course, ultimately banned, partly on the grounds that it posed a law and order problem. But at least one segment of the Indian feminist movement also supported the ban, objecting to the Orientalist framing or white woman's savior complex and civilizing mission that the film supposedly embodies here, as well as its equation of illiteracy and poverty with violence, and for focusing on the views of the rapist. While Edwin's documentary was in fact deeply problematic on all these levels, as well as a number of other levels, the ban denied other Indian feminists and those who opposed the ban the opportunity to critique it. Now, the responses to the Delhi rape, as well as the documentary, much like the responses to the Cologne assaults, detracted once again from the central issue, that is, sexual violence that was central to the initial protests. Instead, the issue came to be incorporated into a security discourse, as well as a nationalist narrative that opposed external intervention and what is perceived as a new kind of gender imperialism. For me, these two narratives raise a very compelling question. Given over two decades of human rights advocacy on gender, how have we arrived at a point where these appalling episodes of violence against women come to be articulated within the discourse of nationalism, race, security, and sexual surveillance, and also displaced onto a first world, third world, us and them divide? The answer cannot be found in simply talking in terms of the success or failure of gender rights advocacy, but requires, I think, a much more complicated response, which I intend to try and provide today. My talk consists of three parts. First, I will provide a general overview, very general and brief, of how 18th and 19th century liberal thought that has been the foundation of human rights has been implicated in establishing racial, cultural, and gender hierarchies evident in the context of slavery as well as the colonial encounter that determine who counted as human and who did not. These hierarchies are integral to liberal governance and continue to inform the post-colonial present, I suggest, as well as human rights, where some subjects have come to be recognized as experiencing injuries and harms that are deemed as unjust, reparable, and remediable, and others not. I will elaborate on this argument, specifically addressing the responses to the refugee influx into Europe today. Secondly, I want to examine how this analysis informs contemporary gender and human rights advocacy, quite specifically in relation to victims of sexual violence, the sex worker and anti-trafficking interventions, and the Muslim woman and the politics around the veil. And thirdly, I ask, how can we move beyond the destructive binaries that inform human rights advocacy on gender and its imperial and colonizing impulse? Now, turning first to the subject of human rights and how she's conceived and constructed. How do we get, what understanding of subject informs human rights? Well, in Precarious Life, Judith Butler argues that some lives can be apprehended as grievable or lost if they are apprehended as living. She questions, under what conditions does it become conceivable to apprehend a life as possible? In Frames of War, she states, this partly depends on, quote, that life being produced according to norms that qualify it as a life, or indeed as part of a life, and that, again in quotes, there are subjects who are not quite, or indeed are never recognized as lives. I borrow from this discussion on precariousness to examine how certain harms and injuries come to be recognized in human rights law as unjust and deserving of repair and remedy. An obvious prerequisite is that the subject in question must be recognized as a subject in the first place. And such recognition, in turn, is based on a set of norms that determine those individuals who can be recognized as subjects and those who cannot, or who are given less recognition. I argue, in fact, human rights produces a hierarchy of human subjects. That is, those who are more or less human, who are subhuman, inhuman, or unthinkable as human, or who are superhuman. While human rights posits the idea of a universal subject and claims about how to be free and equal in the world, the antecedents of this project, found in liberal thought, actually tell a very different story. They expose the history of how claims to universality and inclusion have actually coexisted with exclusion and subordination. Let's recall an earlier moment in the 19th century when Europe was in the midst of its struggles for liberty, equality, and freedom. Europe's others continued to be subjugated under the weight of colonialism and slavery. Even within Europe, gender apartheid established a hierarchy of who or of what or who constituted the liberal subject, the white propertied male. While there is an assumption that certain political values are indeed universal, such as liberty, equality, and freedom, these ideals seem to stumble and falter at the moment of their encounter with the unfamiliar, the other, and difference. And these values, in fact, are met with the same difficulties today in their encounters with unfamiliarity. Universality is always accompanied by what one scholar has suggested is the other side of universality. For liberal thinkers in the late 18th and 19th century, recognition and freedom were based on the capacity to consent, a racial and gender hierarchy, and civilizational maturity. And this is evident even in the work of respected and influential scholars and thinkers such as John Stuart Mill, as well as Immanuel Kant. The other was deemed unfathomable, inscrutable, distant, where culture, amongst other things, demonstrated she was civilizationally backward, a savage, infantile, who could not have the capacity to consent, and where culture was a negative feature largely of the non-West. Colonial subjugation was thus legitimized either as the natural subordination of lesser races to higher ones, or as a means by which to rectify past deficiencies, where the civilizing mission of empire was justified in societies that were stagnant or mired by the stranglehold of custom, tradition, and antiquity. So the purported universal rights of man or human could be denied to those not considered to be human. The criteria for being human played out on a number of sites. For example, there are innumerable documented cases where black African slaves, men and women, were being transported in slave ships, but arrived dead in their incarcerated hold upon reaching their destinations. These ships had become nothing more than floating tombs. Doctors eventually discovered that the slaves had died as a result of dehydration and chronic diarrhea, combined with the psychological hardships of slavery. This marked the discovery of melancholia, that is, mourning and brooding, the sadness that had overcome these captives when they realized they were forced to leave behind families, their homeland, and their freedom. They had experienced, as Mamembe describes it, as death in life. But this finding was not used to advocate for their emancipation, but to further medical science's exploration into the causes of mental illness. The only benefit to the slaves, if it can be called that, was that the slave owners were advised to get their slaves off the ships as soon as possible, before conditions of nostalgia or brooding manifested. And a similar logic is used to continue the subordination of women, where women were understood as different from men, more specifically, weaker and in need of protection. And in the colonial relationship, gender difference was also conflated with cultural backwardness, where the treatment of the other woman was used in part as a justification for colonial intervention and the civilizing mission. What Gayathri Spivak, the post-colonial feminist scholar, has referred to as white men saving brown women from brown men. The empire was able to position itself as a defender of women's rights in the colonial context without, however, fundamentally affecting its own position on gender difference, that women were essentially weak and subordinate, lacking rational abilities, and that this gender difference was natural, biological, and inevitable. So in all these instances, lesser humans or non-humans become disposable or negatable. There are no markers for their existence, either because there was no human there in the first place or no life, or she was merely an object deserving of protection but not subjectivity. Given this history, the idea of a universal subject in human rights as something that is assumed and knowable in advance and serving as a grounding entity is actually put into crisis. Instead, it becomes part of the problem that requires investigation. This structure of human hierarchy continues in the contemporary moment, linked to the Cologne story with which I began. I referenced how scores of refugees have poured into Europe, many to escape the single-minded destruction of their homelands, not only at the hands of their government and extremist groups such as Islamic State, but also the incessant rain of bombs dropped by lethal air power by liberal democratic countries, amongst others, who claim these and earlier interventions serve humanity and are part of a just war. These repeated military interventions are justified as the best hope for saving liberalism, democracy, and women's rights from the chaotic violence of the feudal illiberal societies that are sources of evildoers such as terrorists. Or they're justified as a form of retaliation for attacks, say, in Brussels or in Paris. François Hollande declared that France was at war against the Islamic State in November 2015, and the second day, Hellfire missiles with the inscription, "From Paris with Love," led to the subsequent destruction of large parts of the ancient residential city of Raqqa, the ostensible headquarters of Islamic State. The refugees are now being repackaged and sent back to where they came from through the adoption of measures that may violate human rights, but such rights belong only to humans. In this instance, what seems clear is that refugees do not fulfill the criteria of being human, a potential economic burden. Here, if she sinks, she's a if she drowns, she's a refugee, but if she floats, she's an economic migrant. And this suspicion, of course, then justifies her paying for her plight with her plight, as recently has been done by Denmark, who seizes now the assets of the refugees when they're above a certain value. Or, very controversially, representing them as swarms of rats, as in this Daily Mail British cartoon, which is very like another one back in 1939, published in Das Kleine Blatt, which made a similar fun of the Jews who tried to enter Europe. Or they're culturally unassimilable or prone to criminality. You will know these posters. Lusting for Europe's women or Europe's riches, a threat to Europe's Christian identity, as Prime Minister Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, stated at the beginning of the crisis, or worst of all, a possible terrorist. And these attitudes are once again represented in the Hebdo cartoon, where Ayan Kurdi, again, for whatever reason, is portrayed as expiring so close to his goal, represented as a McDonald's 2-for-1 special for children, and also Europeans walk on water, proof that Europe is Christian and Muslim children sink. While the overt bigotry and inhumanity of these responses have no doubt triggered furious rejoinders, I suggest that this remains insufficient and inadequate, for these responses don't recognize or challenge the idea that the hierarchy of humans is actually constitutive of human rights, rather than something that's an aberration or part of an extreme right-wing politics. In all these instances, lesser humans, there are lesser humans, but not fully humans, hordes who remain unrecognized and ungrievable. So when a human is not recognized, her body becomes nothing, a corpse of non-being, one that becomes wash-awayable without any further ado, as represented in this spectacular exhibit by Ai Weiwei's, a 14,000 salvaged refugee life vests wrapped around the columns of the Berlin Konzerthaus. And without recognition, she becomes, of course, subject to greater precarity. What becomes evident is that in the contemporary moment, it's not the human rights of these precarious subjects that become vital, but the human rights of those in Europe where the Paris and Brussels bombings or the Cologne sexual assaults become the shocking evidence of how human bombs and uncivilized hordes may lurk amongst these subhuman masses. These acts become part of the justifications for keeping such people out or to impose restrictions on their mobility. So now I want to turn to demonstrate how this logic operates in relation to gender and cultural difference in the contemporary moment, focusing specifically on victims of sexual violence campaigns, as well as the sex worker and the veiled woman. And these are all very controversial topics. In the international human rights arena, gender advocacy has been framed within the logic of campaigns confronting violence against women. And the turning point of this came in 1993 at the Vienna World Conference on Human Rights, which recognized that women's rights were human rights, and that violence against women in the public and private sphere should be subject to human rights scrutiny. And that was really very radical, because human rights is applied to the public domain and not the private arena. So it was a very radical shift. And subsequently, of course, there have been a number of conferences on women's rights. But it is really the issue of sexual violence that's received the most attention, evidenced by the proliferation of resolutions and declarations addressing this issue in the UN and human rights apparatus. And the list is very long, but it includes, just briefly list them, the UN Declaration on Violence Against Women, the Security Council Resolution 1325 and 1820 on gender, peace, and security, the appointment of a UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, the inclusion of rape and sexual slavery as crimes against humanity in the Rome Statute, and of course the Palermo Protocols on trafficking in women and children. And these have of course been shored up by the UNITE initiative by the Secretary General on violence against women. So women's human rights have become aligned with stopping violence against women. Now states have responded to this recognition of sexual violence in some cases rather enthusiastically, largely through an overall strengthening of the law and order agenda and a tighter focus on criminal justice provisions, as we saw, for example, in response to the Delhi rape, but it's evident in many jurisdictions. And the women's rights, human rights movement, a part of the women's human rights movement, has also been implicated in encouraging this response through a consistent focus on issues of violence against women and women's victimization. There is no doubt that a rights focus has been important in drawing attention to the lack of domestic violence law, of effective rape laws, but most importantly, providing women with a vocabulary to speak about abuses that have remained hidden and invisible in human rights. There's no doubt about that. But I want to nuance the argument. This overwhelming focus on violence and the victim subject really has several troubling consequences. First, in emphasizing victimization, it's reproduced the image of women as vulnerable, in need of protection, as abject. Second, the victim subject is displaced again onto this first world, third world divide, especially in human rights advocacy, reinforcing the depiction of women from the third world as perpetually marginalized and underprivileged, in need of rescue. The violence against women in the global south, as being located primarily in their culture, reinforces cultural stereotypes and racist representations of that culture, and privileges the culture of the West, reminiscent of colonial understandings of the Eastern woman as victims of a backward or barbaric or uncivilized culture. And I'll elaborate on this in a moment. And finally, the focus on victimization and violence has invited responses and remedies from states, which I suggest have really very little to do with promoting women's rights. They're invariably protectionist and even conservative, measures that make it look like something's being done about women's rights, and therefore a state's progressive credentials are shored up, while in the process actually promoting what is described as a carceral vision or a security regime in response to women's rights, where criminal justice and law and order are preeminent solutions. Let me illustrate this and how deeply problematic it is by looking at these two examples, the first on the sex worker and anti-trafficking campaigns. This carceral vision is acutely evident in anti-trafficking interventions, where there's a consistent and continuous effort on the part of a large number of states, most recently France, to embrace what is referred to as the Nordic model in relation to sex trafficking that criminalizes the clients of the sex worker and various other aspects of the sex industry, though ostensibly not the innocent victim. Now, this approach is usually accompanied by raid and rescue operations and zero tolerance campaigns, together with increased border controls and law enforcement and security measures that affect a much wider range of people and also contribute to the emergence of what I've described as a sexual security regime. Amongst the central casualties in this vision have been sex workers and migrants, but there are others as well. While I'll allude to the implications this has on migrants, my focus is primarily on the sex worker. This model has partly been the outcome of women's human rights advocacy, partly, where trafficking has been equated with sexual exploitation and the sex industry, which does deflect attention from other forms of trafficking and also assumes that all sex workers have been trafficked. The entire industry comes to be framed within the criminal justice and law and order approach, where the success of human rights lies in the dismantling of the very structure of the sex industry and erasure of the sex worker as legible or eligible for human rights, or only eligible as victims to be rescued, as portrayed in this U.S. government poster that's seen at many U.S. embassies of trafficked women represented as bottled and sold on grocery shelves. Organized sex workers movements oppose this move in both the North and the South. Here, French sex workers opposed the move to criminalize clients. And organized Indian sex workers argued that trafficking can be stopped only through the decriminalization of sex works. So actually, human rights has still this capacity to resist and dissent. Their message is that sex work is a human right, and that the Nordic model dehumanizes and criminalizes especially marginalized groups and itself victimizes women. In addition, global anti-trafficking campaigns are powered by stereotypes of poor or third world women, once again as victimized, two-dimensional, truncated subjects who are forever falling as victims to trafficking, violence, cultural barbarity, and are therefore in perpetual need of rescue by their superhuman liberal feminist sisters. It's this problematic representation about third world other women that actually fueled the reaction to the film India's Daughters, as I discussed earlier. And more importantly, these rescue missions have resulted in these women ending up in destitute homes, juvenile centers, and inadequately resourced government shelters, while simultaneously securing and protecting a dominant arrangement of gender and sexuality. Once again, that's dualistic, based on men and women as fixed categories, and it's marital, procreative, heteronormative, and monogamous. And all of this is done primarily through the disentitlement of the sex worker. In the meantime, more importantly, most importantly, I think, trafficking continues to flourish. Here's the rub. Somewhat paradoxically, these interventions have also encouraged the establishment of an unregulated clandestine migrant mobility regime that includes migrant boats, false travel documents and papers, where the female migrant risks becoming a perishable commodity, amongst others. Anti-trafficking interventions have not only increased the precarity and vulnerability of some female migrants, pushing them into networks of traffickers and smugglers, these measures have also affected a broader category of people, giving states enormous power over them and their movements across borders, and thus a central plank in the liberal governance security agenda that is hardly about women's rights or women at all, except as a means to an end. The failure to address the social and economic structural forces, and also an almost exclusive focus on carceral measures, have succeeded in encouraging unsafe movement where safe legal passage remains largely unavailable for certain communities. I now want to turn to the veil. My analysis is further complicated in the context of alterity or difference, where human rights interventions produce this unequivocal choice between cultural identity on the one hand and gender equality on the other. And this stark choice is illustrated in relation to the Muslim woman and the legal response in some jurisdictions to the veil. Legal regulations have imposed restrictions on wearing the veil to varying degrees in a number of European liberal democratic countries, and I really want to dwell on this obsession. There's an underlying assumption that freedom and equality demands its removal by the liberal democratic state, where freedom is associated with the right to choose what we want to wear, except when it is the veil. In France, inclusion is open to those who demonstrate compliance with the assimilative terms of republican secularism. This was the French poster campaign against the headscarves, which was back in 2004. This criteria is reminiscent of the colonial ideal of French cultural competence, where belonging depended on the ability to conform. The veil symbolizes the ultimate subordination of women, and its ban or removal, the ultimate liberation, and the reestablishment of the secular ideal. So in this instance, of course, we need to remember that the bans concerned French female citizens who were Muslims and claimed the veil as part of French identity. But the wearer's choice to wear the veil is either regarded by some states, as well as by some feminists, as false consciousness, even in countries that don't support the ban, because it doesn't conform to this understanding of freedom that's based on autonomy and liberal individualism, or it is regarded as a belligerent act that refuses to comply with the reasonable demands of le vivre ensemble, of living together, as a legitimate aim of the protection of the rights and freedoms of others, as ruled in 2014 by the European Court of Human Rights that upheld the burqa ban in France. Choosing the veil over the non-veil is to choose incarceration over autonomy, and hence no choice at all. But this is also coupled with the idea that only some kinds of women are worth knowing, seeing, and living together with, and therefore fit to be entitled to human rights and recognized as belonging. The question thus becomes not why some women will not renounce the veil as a way of life. Rather, it is a question as to who actually is being liberated from the veil through its legal proscription. In this analysis, ultimately the very terms of equality are used to deny the veiled woman's agency and to align equality and gender equality especially, with the rule of the majority, with the normalized, unveiled, sexualized liberal subject. Thus, the invitation into the liberal democratic space, which is cast as a civilized space and one of the end goals of the human rights project, is not an invitation into a space of lasting, unconditional freedom and equality, but one that seeks to incorporate the gendered sexual other into a regulatory normative apparatus that ensures compliance with certain cultural, sexual, and gender arrangements, while difference continues to be stigmatized, penalized, or erased. And so again, there's another compelling question. Would this then not encourage a turn away from equality rights discourse, which is no longer associated with freedom and empowerment, but with surveillance and a continued scrutinizing and policing of the other or other woman? The veiled woman's choice to wear the veil is never attended to and remains unintelligible within the liberal imaginary. At its extreme, it is nothing more than a body bag from which the body must be liberated. It must be completely removed from public view. From the perspective of the other, the one who wears the veil, it may represent an urge by immigrant women or the citizen against the assimilative practices of majoritarianism of a liberal democracy, or it may be a statement about identity by young adolescent girls who are coerced by the liberal democratic state to choose between the veil or their education when they want both, or a matter, of course, of life or death under the dictates of the Taliban. As Saba Mahmood and others have argued, what's entirely absent from these responses is the experience of the veiled woman and the conception of a self that's based on the relationship of the veil to the inner disposition, the inner being, of some wearers, where freedom lies in a movement inwards as opposed to outwards, as internal, not external. It's an entirely different approach to subjectivity and freedom. And this conception of the self has no relationship to liberal individualism or the embodied subject as a bearer of rights. It's a choice exercise, not only outside of dominant prescriptions of gender equality, but outside the fishbowl universe of human rights and its limited conceptions of the body, of freedom, and of the human. And I strongly suspect that what is so threatening is this articulation of a non-liberal, not illiberal, experience of freedom outside of the liberal constellation and of a subject or self that's outside the terms and reach of liberal individualism. Let me finally elaborate on just how the human rights in the contemporary moment embrace a determinate conception, a specific conception of the gendered subject, and drive specific understandings of how to be free. In the war launched in March 2003 to liberate Afghan women, supported by some feminists, and also what some liberal scholars have described, this was the last one on the veil. The veil goes to jail. And here, what some liberal scholars have described as the first war on gender liberation. Representations of women unveiled, welcoming U.S. Marines, masked more than they revealed. As Butler states, liberation is conditioned on the idea that the Marines were bringing freedom from a brutal and unjust regime, and the images of women pulling back the veil and smiling, which is read as welcoming, one of joy and freedom experienced partly through the removal of the veil. What is rendered invisible in these images is the devastation wreaked by the war in Afghanistan, a region relentlessly militarized over the past 35 years, including by liberal democratic states, the regrouping and reestablishment of the Taliban, as well as the complex politics that surrounds the veil in Afghanistan and elsewhere. 13 years on, the veil remains, violence against women and other civilians continues on a staggering scale, and the saviors have become indistinguishable from the perpetrators. Military interventions under the banner of gender liberation render invisible the unconscionable harms of war and the lives lost of women and countless others who become nothing more than disposable bodies in the mechanics of the art of war. In conclusion, I want to end with what I can only describe as really tentative observations and proposals. First, coming back to the Cologne assaults, the Cologne and Delhi assaults, and the representations of the Delhi rape in India's daughters, the pursuit of gender and human rights along fixed and rigid gender dualisms, as well as racial and cultural divides, is not a recipe for freedom, but of the continuation and reinforcement of deeply destructive binaries, gender and cultural stereotypes. The challenge is, how do we demolish these binaries and understand that the violence inflicted on women in Cologne and in Delhi were not random events perpetrated by uncivilized hordes or illiterate poor men, but part of the widespread discrimination and violence against women. At the same time, this is also crucial, we need to resist the universalizing zeal of human rights in gender advocacy that becomes culturally hegemonic and often becomes an imperial torchbearer of freedom, leaving us with a result that can be so politically divisive and, in fact, can only lead us in the direction of unfreedom. Second, we need to constantly deal with the fact that individuals or communities who are denied recognition or legal status want recognition through rights. In other words, we cannot not want human rights, but this fact should not limit us from questioning how this engagement has simultaneously triggered coercive responses, as I've illustrated in the context of violence against women interventions, as well as interventions in the context of equality rights. Responses that presume to know what is good for other women. We must ask whether prescribing particular behavior, such as the veil, or particular conduct, such as sex work, enables those on the side of good intentions to then experience these women as their equal in every way. Human rights are shadowed by who is not included, who cannot claim them, or can only be included on specific terms. This is the dark side of human rights, which is implicated in the unfreedom of the other. Inclusion is not the antidote, because, as I've argued, human rights are structured by dominant gender, sexual, and cultural norms. And so inclusion, while important, it's not transformative or revolutionary. So a third and related proposal is really to stop viewing gender and human rights within a linear progressive register and assume we're the good guys. Instead, we need to closely monitor the work that gender does in women's rights and human rights advocacy, as well as by other players, the state, aid agencies, and the market, and how it's used at times to obscure the bigger picture. As I've tried to demonstrate in the context of gender, human rights are a tool of governance, liberal governance, and it is the power in the hands of those who use it that must be understood, rather than a pursuit that places faith in the ability of human rights to transform the lives of women and other marginalized groups for the better or to bring about freedom. Let me stress that this critique of human rights and the way in which gender is addressed is not to side with the cultural nationalists, the inhuman, the anti-human, or evil. Human rights remain important tools of defiance and resistance, as I mentioned earlier, against the diminishing space of protest and dissent for women, such as the veiled woman, the sex worker, the female migrant, represented, I think, captured in this iconic image that took place only a couple of weeks ago in Sweden. But more specifically, The critique is also a form of space clearing directed at recuperating emancipatory projects that have been marginalized by the conceit of human rights. The conceit of human rights being it assumes it is the answer. It's benevolent, it's good, and it's progressive. So my final point is to encourage a deeper reflection and thoughtfulness and openness, not only to the plural and multiple ways in which gender is understood and lived, performed, and experienced beyond gender dualisms, as well as how freedom can be experienced beyond liberalism and rights accumulation. My talk, I hope, encourages a search for answers beyond the limited horizons of the liberal imaginary and productive engagements, and encourages productive engagements with other modes of being and thinking, as Mahmoud suggests, to be remade in the process of engaging another's worldview and learn things that we did not already know before we undertook the engagement. To end, perhaps, what I've proposed here is not merely a transformative vision of human rights and gender or just fixing it, but in fact, a major reorientation in our thinking about these notions. Thank you.